The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Okay, well, let's get back to work here. Number six on this team is a diaconal worker. Now, the diaconal worker, again, reflects this holistic approach to mission. And that is, he represents Jesus in his compassion and mercy toward those who suffer. And just as the diaconate belongs to the church and is part of the church's, not only the special offices of the church, but also part of the essential ministry of the church, so the church planting team should be reflecting that. Now you might say, why can't the church planter handle that? Why do you need a specially gifted and trained person? Well, possibly one or two of these people would have those gifts and training. But now what if you're working, for example, in a very poor barrio where the illiteracy is 80% and there aren't any schools? Now what is the response of the Christian compassionate heart to ignorance, poverty, illiteracy, grinding conditions that continue year after year, when you know that education could make the difference? Well, obviously, you start a small school next to the church, huh? And so you use this little church on Sundays for services, and at night for the meetings, and then during the day you have a little school. Well, what are you doing? Well, you are attacking poverty, injustice, oppression. Like our children are working in the Dominican Republic with Haitians. The Dominicans don't give a nickel for these Haitians, see? They don't care if they just stay stupid and ignorant year after year, as long as they're willing to work in the cane fields. Okay, well now what? We've got 135 churches among these Haitians. What is the church's duty? Well, it's a diaconal duty. It may be educational, it may be literacy, it may be community development, it may be hygiene. Right now, for example, in the 135 churches, we have one nurse whose job is, imagine this, she's got a carpenter who builds a little baldaquin, a little medicine cabinet, which is mounted on the wall on the inside of the church, with the most rudimentary medications, bandages, and then she trains a pastor, maybe the pastor's wife, somebody in the church, in areas of hygiene, simple medicine. Well, what is that? That's a diaconal function. Now, maybe nobody else in this team has those gifts and qualifications or the time. Okay. The diaconal role is dependent on the conditions. It responds to the needs of an area. They may be literacy, they may be educational, they may be hygiene, they may be sanitation, they may be agricultural. Maybe the thing to do is, these kids don't get enough protein. Teach people how to raise rabbits or goats. Huh? Get some proteins into these covenant kids, because the church will benefit as well as the individual involved. Okay, now, I'm suggesting that an appropriate diaconal ministry, appropriate to the needs of an area, be included in the team. Now, I could imagine if, for example, you were working and we were talking about the PCA strategy for the upper classes. Well, maybe they don't need any of this stuff. Maybe the big thing for them is counseling, because their marriages are coming apart as they make all this money. Maybe that almost becomes a diaconal. Wouldn't you call that a diaconal function? Really? They don't need to know how to raise rabbits. They need to know how to keep their marriages intact. Well, whatever, but Christ, the merciful one, has to be translated into acts of mercy, and that usually means someone with the gifts and the training and the time to specialize in that area. And the trouble is, in our churches, we've reduced the diaconal office just to collecting the offering on Sunday and counting the pennies and making a report. And, you know, anybody can do that. I always argued with my deacons, why, you know, let anybody count the money. You know, get some retirees to come on Monday morning and do it and have a good time and drink coffee and take it to the bank. No, the deacons had to do that. The diaconal job is too big and important to be spending their time counting the pennies. This is a big ministry, diaconal ministry. Look at the qualifications. They're virtually the same as for elders. But it's hard to get that across. Well, what do you think? Ask questions about it. Yeah, and he will train, he trains the deacons in the churches. Again, transfer of technology. Exactly. Yeah, and I think this is where the deaconess comes in. Because there are diaconal functions that a woman can do much better, and a man shouldn't even be doing it. You got the unwed mother with three kids, or the widow. Can you teach her or help her in a lot of the areas where she needs help? I can't, you can't either. We're males. But a deaconess could do it very effectively. And I think that's where these scattered references to deaconesses came in the scriptures. I think it was a functional application of the principle that Christ the deacon, you know, he's called that once, Christos diakonos, Christ the deacon has to be lifted up, proclaimed in word and deed. And when that calls for a woman should do it. But what has happened so often in missions is that this, in recent years, has become a separate branch. Now, in the Christian Reformed Church, we have the Christian Reformed World Relief Committee, which has a separate board. The Mennonites have the same problem. They've got a separate agency that is carrying on the diaconal. And I think that's unfortunate. I wish they were all part of the one team working under one mandate rather than seeing these things get separated. But that's one of the realities of our present world, is specialization sometimes breaks apart what God intended to keep together. The seventh member on the team, and I hate to put this last, and it looks like such a sort of the flunky job, and I don't mean it to be that, but I call this a secretary assistant. This could be a man or a woman. It could be a wife of one of the other team members. But a person with stenographic ability, organizational ability, a person with the great gift here would be service. Because in every operation, there are a lot of things that need to be done which don't fit into any professional category. And yet, somebody's got to do them. And on almost every mission team, there'll be somebody who kind of does this sort of thing. I think it's got to be recognized with dignity and respect. And, you know, a good typist on a mission field and on a team can be a tremendous help. What was John Mark assigned to do on that team? Well, he was to be a helper. We don't know exactly, and of course he didn't work out very well. He quit, maybe because he didn't think his job had very much dignity. But he was along to help carry the baggage. And hey, we need those kind. And that too is part of God's operation. And instead of seeing that as a flunky job, I think it ought to be right out there as an integral part of the total operation. And of course, this person may be young. These people may be short-termers, but they are carrying out an important function. You know, right now there's a man and his family down in Argentina, here from Philadelphia, John Evans. Any of you know him, John Evans? John Evans and his wife Nell and their two kids are down in Argentina doing office work for René Padilla. John went down with a computer, and he went down to help organize a library that was in disarray, to get organized the files that were all messed up. And he went down, I think, for about a year and a half, 2 years. They'll be back in June, I believe. It's kind of short term, but to be a generalist, to do a whole lot of odds and ends, which requires some professional skills, but don't fit into the other rubrics. All the years I was on the mission field, I always hired a national secretary. I did in Sri Lanka and I did in Mexico. I had one in Mexico work for me for 7.5 years. Just a fantastic young woman who helped me a lot with Spanish and could turn my, if I wanted to publish something or so, she could take my poor Spanish and turn it into good Spanish. And did this kind of thing. And I think it's important. Any question about that? Well, I hadn't really developed that, but I suspect that he or she might. In fact, maybe that should be the goal, that after a while, whatever skills and gifts that person has are transferred. I guess in all of these things, we're recognizing the plurality of gifts within the one mission of the church. And all of these people must be gift-orientated also as they look for gifted people within the developing churches. And I think over here especially, these people must be very perceptive as to where the gifts are being distributed and where they're appearing. These teachers of teachers, perhaps can be the informants of the others as to what they see developing as they begin to teach and develop national leaders. They will perceive where the gifts are. And when we begin to look at hospitality and service and just humdrum office work also as something based on God's gifts, as having dignity, then some people who may feel very insignificant about themselves, they're going to realize that they're part of this team too, with equal dignity to the church planter or the TEE specialist. I guess that's all rooted in the great Protestant doctrine of the priesthood of all believers. And that, I guess there should be a circle. Yeah.
You wouldn't want to rank them.
I really wouldn't want to rank them. I think that there's a kind of order built in to the into the team's operation, and this is a stage where I'll tell you I'm thinking a lot about this because, well, for one thing, the team approach to church growth, church planting, is the big thing right now. This is PCA's into it, and other boards are getting into it too. Now, I think there's a lot of variations we can. We can talk about the missionary team. PCA sends a team, something like this, to Acapulco. Assignment, plant an entire presbytery in 10 years. And they have a time frame, they know what they want. They want 5 organized churches with elders and pastors by 1990. And they have a number of these. Tom Courtney is the TEE person, Dye is a church planter, and they've got somebody in CE, they've got a woman missionary who's a musician. They've kind of got a number of those on the team. Fine. That's a missionary team. I'm thinking of another stage where you take a missionary team and you train a national team. This team could go and plant a presbytery in 10 years in a fairly receptive area. But I'm thinking of a missionary team of people who have done it, who've had some experience, now going and training national teams and multiply their efforts that way. You see, this church planter could do an institute with 6 or 10 gifted, church-planting, inclined nationals in his class, and soon he would have a proliferation of churches, because they wouldn't only be passing on their gifts and their skills to one person in the process of doing it, but they would do it on an organized scale to greatly multiply the number of people with their corresponding gifts, the TEE to TEE people, CE to CE, and so forth, all the way down. Now, that's the thing I'm kind of interested in. In fact, I've been sketching something that might even refine this to a mobile institute. What if we could take Tom Courtney from Acapulco, Ron Brunson from Mexico City, somebody else from, say, Dirksen from wherever he is right now, and send them seriatim for intensive 2 or 3 week training sessions to key urban locations within the language group that they could handle. Just for example, if in Santo Domingo, the missionaries would say, look, we have 5 nationals whom the Lord is gifting and moving toward thinking in terms of church planting, but they don't know much about it. Okay, Tom Courtney or Ron Brunson, who started a number of churches, you come over here and you give them a 2 week intensive poor man's ecclesiology. Okay? Barefoot stuff of what this church should look like. And then turn them loose. 4 months later, a number two specialist flies in. And he, now he's not going to work with those church planters. He's going to work with the people that are beginning to surface as potential leaders in the groups they've started. And he works with them. Okay? And about that same time, a woman comes in who's got some training in CE. And she starts classes, does 3 weeks of intensive training classes at night for those who are going to be doing a lot of the Sunday school teaching. Okay? And all the way along the line, putting this thing on a mobile basis, I think it could be done on a lot. See, the trouble is in so many urban areas now, boards are wanting to go urban, but they don't have the budget for it. They don't have the trained personnel for it. Missionaries are scared of the big cities. They feel much more comfortable out in the pueblos. Number three, they're afraid of the budgets for land and buildings. And I'd like to circumvent that problem by going in with training teams. Forget the building, the property problem for the moment. Just train the people. Train the national church planters. Train the nationals to do TEE. Train CE people. And then the churches will come. And you'll solve the property problem by the people that are going to be moving into the church, and they'll find their solutions. There's another thing that could be done, and that is if in major cities we could have an institute, maybe in a church building, you don't have to have special property for it, but an institute for urban church planting. And you would develop here a whole year-round series of training classes to which particularly nationals would come for the training. And you would have a curriculum built around the 7 components of a holistic urban church planting strategy. You think of what that could do. Plant one of those in Mexico City and open it up interdenominationally. Let the Presbyterians and the Methodists and the Baptists all just train them in the basics. Let them use their own denominational material. How to use a program textbook. How to organize a TEE class. How to develop a balanced curriculum and training program for your Sunday schools. A couple of thoughts on what it takes to motivate growth in a church. I was doing some thinking about this the other day. Because, you know, we spend a lot of time talking methods and strategies, but it boils down to motivation. All these things take an enormous amount of energy. Somebody's got to be willing to push a mountain. And I identified six or seven principles of motivation in a church or a mission. And the first is that people are motivated by the Holy Spirit. Now that sounds so simplistic, but you know, that old expression that the Lord has laid his hand on somebody. Now what does that mean? The Lord doesn't reach out with a five-fingered hand and press down on someone's shoulder. But what is motivation in the church and in missions? But just that. That the Lord stirs a person. That internal compulsion that simply won't quit, that won't die down. That you are motivated to do what you would never do otherwise. And that, of course, is why Jesus said, look at the harvest fields, for they're white under harvest. And then he didn't say, well, go on and produce a 16-millimeter film to promote missions or organize a campaign. He said, pray. Because it is finally and first of all, that hand of the Lord touching a person, not letting you forget or ignore or do anything other than this new direction. And that's the motivating power of the Holy Spirit, and that the only thing we can do to promote that is pray. Number two, motivation comes through capable leaders. You know, dull, unimaginative leaders don't motivate anybody. That's why we need the best in missions. We don't need the flunkies. We need the best. A lot of people have always thought that the flunkies could go into missions. But, you know, missions is so tough that even the best aren't enough. And we need the most capable people we can get. Number three, motivation comes through a new vision. You don't get motivated by yesterday's visions. Motivation comes through capturing a new vision of something that the Lord wants done and nobody's been doing it. This is where Ralph Winter has had such tremendous power. Ralph Winter has been one who has seen new visions and he's communicated them well, particularly to young people. His unreached peoples concept. Now, missionaries have been looking for the unreached since the year one. There's nothing really new about it, and yet he got out his calculator. He's a trained engineer, and he came up with this 17,500 unreached peoples, which is the most ridiculous calculation there is. As he facetiously said one time, it's big enough to grab people, and it's small enough they can handle. It could just as well have been 18,000 or 16,000 or somewhere in between. Or who knows, if you go into the sociological breakdown of unreached peoples, that you can have any number. But the point is, he got this 17,600 unreached peoples, and people started, you know, lights started going on. Now that's motivation, a new vision. Like Joel said and Peter quoted, young men shall see visions and old men shall dream dreams. And upon your servants and your handmaidens, huh? Even the women are going to be involved in that. We mustn't say that. Erase it, Darcy. Number four, motivation comes through personal, meaningful participation. As long as the vision remains mine and doesn't become yours, in a way in which you could see yourself as part of this, you're never going to be deeply motivated. But when you and I together see how we could be on this team, huh, that's when things start cooking. Now, whether it's in the local church or in missions. The leader has to show every Tom, Dick, and Harry that the goals and the roles and the program need him, need her, and they're going to be part of it. Shared, meaningful participation. No flunkies on this team. Everybody is blue ribbon, number one. And then people give their heart and soul to it. Number five, I think motivation requires the smooth dissemination of information, the smooth flowing of information. Whether this is in the local church or in a big mission operation, when people feel that they're being kept in the dark, they're not motivated. If you want to raise that budget, if you want to raise the money that's needed, keep everybody informed. Keep the information coming out of the session meetings. And some of those Baptist preachers who spend 10 minutes out of every morning worship service with announcements and telling about what happened, you know, some of us, we don't like that. They say, hey, we're here to worship God. We don't like all this chitter chat about what's going on and what's coming up. But hey, you know, those fellows aren't so dumb. What they're doing is they're using that hour when most people are there. It's the hour when you can reach the most people. They're getting the information out there. And everybody's hearing it, and maybe they've got the same thing on their bulletin too, but he's using the opportunity for the flow of information. Motivation comes through information. We can't get excited about what we don't know, haven't heard about. And especially if we think we're not being told when we ought to be. That causes trouble every time. This is true in raising your support too as a missionary. In my church, why, it's the mission board's number one responsibility to have a lot of information flowing. If you're having to raise your own support, you've got to work on the prayer letters. And you know, when those sag, when those lag, the checks don't come. Motivation requires information. And number seven, motivation almost always... six? Oh, pardon me, number six, evidence of, there has to be evidence for sustained motivation. That's what I'm thinking of here. For sustained motivation, there has to be evidence of progress. Now, when a new idea is born, you can generate motivation just with the idea, the dream, the vision. But a couple years down the road, there'd better be some progress, or motivation is going to lag. I'm thinking of one mission enterprise right now that was born with a tremendous burst of enthusiasm, and a lot of people committed themselves to this vision. But the mission organization has not been able to deliver what it promised. And then you get reverse dynamics entering in, and people become disillusioned. And certainly motivation then degenerates fast. So there has to be evidence that the goals of the mission, of the church, of the organization are at least being reasonably met. And this again requires a number of things to be happening, including the dissemination of information. After all, why should I be motivated to support or to sacrifice for something that is not accomplishing anything? And then number seven, motivation requires that the leaders set an example in terms of commitment, lifestyle, dedication. The leaders must model the thing they're talking about. Now, in a black church where the minister is emphasizing very much that God will bless those who are faithful and that success and prosperity lie ahead for those who live by God's commandments, the Cadillac he drives may be part of the picture he's painting before the congregation. I don't have to drive a Cadillac. I question perhaps why any of God's servants need Cadillacs, but I guess what I'm trying to say is, what is it that motivates people to support any cause? Now, I can think of some very little flunky inner city black churches where the pastor drives up and parks in front with this 85 Cadillac, and the people love it. They support this. Now, he's modeling something there which motivates. If I talked urban and lived in plush suburbia, my integrity would be questionable. Now, the local pastor in a local church has to show by his example that he means what he says. The missionary, the same thing. Motivation requires that those who do the leadership, who do the leading, have integrity. They model it, they demonstrate it, they're committed to it. Now, what other things motivate? Those are seven. Can you think of any more? What motivates people to give themselves their money, their time, their lives?
Concrete goals.
Clarity of goals. And then communicate it. That's a good one. Now, with that, you run risks, because sometimes things don't turn out, even in the best intentioned organization. Now, that's an interesting question. What about the new light, the new vision, the special revelation that someone gets? I'll give you a great example of that. Who's the faith healer that saw the vision of Jesus telling him
Oral Roberts.
The hospital. And he saw Jesus, a 700-foot Jesus, who tells him to build this hospital. Now, the last I heard, the hospital's not doing very good. I think he needs a new vision. But now, that is an interesting phenomenon, that there are people who become very highly motivated because of someone else's supernatural vision. What do we say about that? Is that simply an aberration that is sub-Christian or anti-Christian, or what do you think? I suppose it's kind of an aberration or a variation of number one. The Holy Spirit motivates, and some people may accept what another person says the Holy Spirit has said to him. But, well, how does that work in your culture? Is that a high motivational factor?
I think so.
Yeah, how can you be against a vision, huh? Yeah. If God's given you the vision, then we all have to obey. Yeah.
It's not democratic.
No. Visions are very undemocratic. See, that's totally outside of our Presbyterian experience, isn't it?
I mean, that,
huh?
I know.
How do you distinguish between decision-making by consensus and groupthink?
Well, there's several that come up, like seven key things, where no matter what, you ought to be together.
Yeah.
No
big
what.
Throng all right. Drinking Coca-Cola.
And no right. Matter what.
I think that there are some cultures that are more prone to this kind of thing than others. I think that the charismatic movement has spread in cultures where supernatural visions of some kind are sort of expected. And I think that leadership in those cultures can use and misuse this kind of sort of a propensity towards supernatural revelation of a very personal kind. And I suspect that an awful lot of that is happening.
Well, people get motivated, though.
They do.
Yeah,
that's right. Now, I think the other dynamics we were talking about come into play. Certainly good information flow. You get on the mailing list of one of those charismatic groups and you find out how they get the information out and the evidence of progress. They're always giving flamboyant reporting of what's happening, how many miracles and answers to prayer and that sort of thing. And that, again, motivates people all the more. Nothing succeeds like success, they say. We go perhaps in the other direction, but with some reason. Yeah. Listen, have I given you, in the course of this semester, I have this in my notes, and I should have given it earlier, the five types of leaders that all young churches need, that fits in with this, and maybe I'll give that next week then, because it fits in. The team has to know what kind of a church it wants to develop. The proper vision of what the church should be is basic to church growth. We're not just out there doing our thing and let it, like a person who's making a stew or a porridge and just sort of pours it all in and hopes it comes out and it's edible. We have biblical mandates and a lot of church history to tell us what the church should look like within the context and the culture and so forth. And I'll begin there next week, but I think it's something that is worth looking at.